Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, this is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Thursday, November 21st, day number 323 of 2013. Tonight, we got a lot to get into tonight. We've got Leslie Eastman, who's going to be joining us, as well as Barry Jacobson a little bit later. We're going to talk about everything that's going on in the news. We're also going to remember President Kennedy, obviously tomorrow, the big anniversary of his assassination. We're going to talk about Obamacare. We're going to talk about Vietnam. Barry is going to tell us a little bit about the Vietnam War and one of the important battles of that war. So we've got a lot to get into tonight with both Leslie and Barry. One of the things that happens is that, you know, we seem to there's so much going on in the news, and we not always have the time to get to all of it, but hopefully we will tonight. My book, Cubanos in Wisconsin, you can get yourself a copy of the book at the Amazon. You can get it print or Kindle at the Amazon, or you can go to our website, Cubanos in Wisconsin, and get yourself a copy of the book. Once again, I want to say thanks to my good friend Israel Ortega of the Heritage Foundation for doing a wonderful review of the book. And speaking of the book, I'm going to be on Channel 49 here in Dallas tomorrow morning, very early. They want me there at 5 o'clock in the morning, my goodness. But they have a very early morning show. And we're going to be talking a little bit about President Kennedy and, of course, in the context of what happened with Cuba. As you know, Cuba was one of the main topics of the early Kennedy years. So we'll be on Channel 49 tomorrow morning here in the Dallas area. We're going to take a break. We've got Leslie Eastman on the other side. Silvio Canto in Dallas. Let me say hello to Leslie Eastman all the way in San Diego. How are you tonight, Leslie?
Well, grateful to be able to join you for another fun, entertaining, and informative Thursday, Silvio.
You know, you're exactly right, Leslie. The news is just so exciting. I mean, there's so much to talk about. You've got Obamacare, obviously. There's so much stuff to get into. It is truly remarkable.
Well, I think I know what I'm going to ask for Christmas, Silvio. News day, so we can actually talk about the agenda I had originally slated for a program one evening.
Well, we'll get to it. It's just that Washington keeps making our life so exciting. Today alone, there's several things going on. But let's do a little bit of On This Day in History, Leslie. And I thought I go back. I've got actually two things, but I'll bring up the second one when Barry joins us in a few minutes later. But in 1980, I don't know how many people remember this, that would be 33 years ago, millions of people were tuning their TVs tonight to watch the episode of Dallas, because this was the night that we were finding out who shot JR. So, that was pretty exciting 33 years ago. Were you a fan of Dallas?
Actually, it turns out I was. I would look forward to an episode every evening. It was just in college, too. I was 18 years old and just really got into the whole glamorous lifestyle that depicted on screen. Really, the plot line captivated me, as did the character, especially as I was fond of J.R. Ewing.
So is that what got you into it, the characters? I mean, they were very interesting characters in that show.
Yeah, I think so. You know, a good program makes characters, you know, intriguing, and you want to find out what happens to them the next week. And so many of the successful series do just that. And perhaps one of the most memorable characters in all of television history is J.R. Ewing. And, you know, you
Absolutely.
Can still find people, you know, seeing images and getting drawn back into the early 1980s, a very iconic program indeed.
Absolutely. And you can go anywhere in the world, and I'm sure some of our listeners have had that experience. You can go anywhere in the world, and you tell people you're from Dallas, and I'll bet you 80% of the time they're going to say, oh, Dallas, the TV show, J.R. Ewing. It had a tremendous international appeal, and it really became almost like a calling card for the city of Dallas. Everywhere you went, everybody was talking about JR. I mean, tremendous international appeal. I think it was available in not just English and Spanish, but it was available in just about every language in the world where they have television, Leslie.
Yeah, I remember going to Egypt in 1988, and the Egyptians would stop everything they were doing to watch reruns that were being shown in that country. So it made an impact globally as well.
That's right. That's right. Well, I mentioned that I have another one, another on this day in history that I like to bring up when Barry joins us. Do you have one that did you select one, or we'll jump to the other one that I had selected?
Well, if Barry's available, I say jump right in. We've got lots to talk about in today's history.
That's right. Well, let's say hello to Barry. How are you, Barry?
I am well, Silvio. And Leslie, how are you?
Good.
Absolutely wonderful. Always a great honor to have you on the program. We're going to tie this into what you're going to talk about a little bit later, Barry, but on this day in history, 1967, General William Westmoreland, who I think was he the head of the Army, I guess at that time, he was basically telling the news media, we're winning in Vietnam. Actually, we were winning in Vietnam, but that wasn't always reported, Barry.
Well, first of all, Westmoreland was commander of American forces in Vietnam.
Okay.
He was an overall commander of the entire army, but he was commander of our troops over there. And you're right. He was correct in the fact we were winning. Doesn't mean we had won the war, and doesn't mean we were going to necessarily win the war, but at that snapshot of time, it depends on how you measure victory. The biggest mistake we made in Vietnam, we'll get to this more later, but the biggest mistake was we relied too much on body count and too little on the larger strategic picture. You have to win a war at the highest level. You have to break the enemy's will to fight, and that wasn't really achieved until Nixon decided to bomb the heck out of the North, and we finally broke
the
will.
That's right, and that happened later on with President Nixon. Well, why don't we start with the present? What's going on in the world today before we get to Vietnam? Leslie, I thought maybe we could start with President Kennedy, the big ceremony tomorrow here in Dallas, and, of course, the 50th anniversary. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, as always, this is a time to reflect upon what that era meant to us as a country, and I've been following the various news stories about the commemorations. But probably the most interesting to me are all the different conspiracy theories that have evolved through the years. You know, one involving the mafia, one involving the CIA, another one says Castro did it, and you know, most entertainingly, perhaps, Lyndon Baines Johnson was directly responsible for the Kennedy assassination. However, I was all of like one in change when Kennedy was shot, and probably the most dramatic thing that comes out of that for me personally was my father worked for the Detroit Free Press. He was literally on the floor, and there were bells that rang out the importance of a news story as it would come through the wires. And there was a five-bell story coming off the presses, and my father remembers the only time that the five-bell story occurred was at the end of World War II, so somebody remarked, well, quipping, maybe the president just got shot, and sure enough, that's what happened. But in terms of what actually went down in history, Barry is far more versed on the particulars, and I'd like to get his thoughts on it.
Yeah. You were probably a little older than – you and I were just a little bit older than Leslie that day. So what is your memory of that day?
Well, I was in second grade, but I had started school a little bit late, so I was actually eight years old. Just about 8 years old, be eight in a couple weeks. So I remember pretty vividly, the announcement came over the loudspeaker that the president had been shot. And, you're that young, it doesn't impact you like it did the adults. The teachers were all crying. But they dismissed school, and we went home, and my mother was glued to the television. And she was a little black and white TV we had back then. Mm-hmm. And she was crying also, and but, Kennedy had always been my hero even back then. My dad was very political, and I was very much involved with politics from as early as I can remember. And I idolized, like many people, his style and his charisma. So I was shaken up by it, and I think many of us can say that we really lost a bit of our innocence about politics in America the day that he died.
Yeah, that's the narrative. Well, I remember I was laying down on the floor. I was actually still living in Cuba at the time, and I was laying down on the floor, and the phone rang, and my mom went to answer the phone. She answered the phone. She said, hello. And then there was a certain amount of silence, maybe 30 seconds, and then my mother screams, "They've killed Kennedy." And that was, that's how I learned about it. Probably, I'm guessing maybe it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, so it was a couple of hours after it actually happened. What I find fascinating about the Kennedy assassination is that it was the first assassination in the age of television. So people learned about it very quickly. If you compare it to some of the other presidential assassinations, Lincoln or McKinley or Garfield, in the case of those three men, a lot of the country didn't find out right away. Maybe some found out the next day because of telegrams and so on. But with President Kennedy, most of the country learned of the assassination really within an hour, I'm going to guess. There were lots and lots of housewives watching TV, and they probably saw the breaking story. And then, of course, they called their husbands and said, "What happened?" So the whole country, I'm going to guess, Barry, within an hour, the whole country was aware of the fact that the president had been shot and killed.
I think you're right. And, of course, the question, interesting, your mother said they killed Kennedy. She didn't say someone killed Kennedy. And to this day, that's really the big question is, was it a him, a single person, or was it some sort of conspiracy? And I was just talking to Leslie about this earlier in the week. And I'm an expert marksman. I'm a former Special Forces operator. I rated expert on my rifle tests. I don't think with a modern semi-automatic rifle, I would have too much trouble doing that shot. I'd at least in a 1 out of 3, right? But I don't think with the weapon that Lee Harvey Oswald used, which was a $5 rifle, and literally he bought it online or by mail for about $5. It was a cheap Italian carbine. Italians were not in World War II. Were not famous for the weaponry. This is an old World War II bolt action rifle. I don't think I could have made the shots that Lee Harvey Oswald supposedly killed Kennedy with. So I'm of the belief that there was another shooter as well.
Yeah. So you believe that you don't subscribe to the sole assassin theory? I guess that what you're saying.
I don't. I think Lee Harvey Oswald obviously was involved, but though there is a theory he was a patsy and that the KGB had infiltrated a lookalike, that seems a little far-fetched. But I think there was probably at least one other shooter, maybe a third shooter, triangulating fire. And Lee Harvey Oswald was involved, but he wasn't the lone gunman.
Well, that's an interesting point. I pretty much accepted the Warren Commission report, and I've been disconnected from conspiracy theories for really over 10 years. I just have not been following any of them. But maybe, Leslie, maybe next year for the next anniversary of President Kennedy, we can do a show on the conspiracy. But I think the reason we remember Kennedy, I'll say one more thing and then we'll move on to the other topics. But I think the reason we remember Kennedy so much is because in many ways he is a little bit like a blank slate. In other words, he can be whatever you want him to be. If you want him to be a conservative, he can be a conservative. If you want him to be a liberal, he can be a liberal. He can be a lot of things. He never gets old because he died young. So there's a certain quality to him that, you know, none of the other presidents will ever have. I mean, because they had to govern, they had to make decisions. And Kennedy, you know, he was only there for 34 months. So I think he benefits a little bit from that, Leslie. I'm not trying to take away anything from him, but he does benefit from the assassination, I think.
No, it's amazing. A lot of the iconic people who died young, think Marilyn Monroe. She's always in the hearts as somebody young and vibrant. Would have been quite different if she lived, kind of like Elizabeth Taylor, with drama and then age at the very end. So there's a lot to be said for that. And, you know, but still a legacy that made our country proud, which I think is going to differ quite a bit than the legacy the current president is leaving behind.
You're exactly right. And speaking of the current president, let's say that was a great great way to get us. Yes, I thought that was that couldn't be any better. But we're having a few problems in Washington with our current president. Obamacare, of course, quite a mess. And Barry, you sent me a message today about this thing in the Senate where they've changed the rules. I think that's very short-sighted, Barry, and I'd like to get both of you guys' thoughts on this, but I think it's very short-sighted for the Democrats to do what they did, Barry.
No, I think you're right. It's a double-edged sword. You know, on one level, it's incredibly hypocritical that the same party, the Democrats, and some of the same individuals, Obama, Reid, Biden, basically said that if when the Republicans in 2005, when they had the majority in the Senate, tried to do the very same thing, or at least were discussing doing the same thing, and
right,
they never got around to doing it, they said that was, they called it the nuclear option. It was basically going to destroy politics in Washington, poison the well forever. It was trampling the race of the minority. You know, Biden said it was the most important vote he had taken in 35 years was the vote to block the changing of these rules. And now here we are, you know, when the shoe is on the other foot, and now it's perfectly all right to change that rule. And the rule basically has been around since the Founding Fathers in one form or another. Let me just reflect back. When Thomas Jefferson asked George Washington, this is how far back this goes, you know, why they needed this, George Washington replied, "Why do you pour your hot coffee into your saucer?" For those who don't do that anymore, it's an old custom. You take the hot coffee and pour a little bit in your saucer, and it allows it to cool on a wider surface. And that's what Jefferson said, allows it to cool down. And Washington said, well, and that's why we need this. We need time for the people to reflect when in the hotbed of the House of Representatives, where the representatives are can the majority dominates and bills come fast and furious through the in the passion of emotion, the passion of the moment, come through, and they reach the Senate. The Senate is supposed to slow it down and deliberate, and the minority is supposed to be able to put the brakes on, and that's what the filibuster does. Now, by doing this, Obama and Reid have obliterated that tradition, and the Senate will now be just another version of the House, and it will rush things through, and the majority will get whatever they want, and you'll see Supreme Court justices confirmed by the party in control of the Senate and the White House, with the minority having no chance to stop it. You're going to see some very radical justices coming through without a filibuster. Men so far to the left, they would never get confirmed on either the Supreme Court or the Washington or the D.C. Court of Appeals, which is the second most powerful circuit, the one that overlooks all the regulations coming through the bureaucracy, all the hearings on those regulations. And that's really what this is all about. This is an attempt to pack the federal bench with radical leftists, with
right,
no opposition from the Republicans being allowed. But
that's
it's going
right,
to come back to Biden, because the Democrats will get this when the Democrats lose the Senate and they lose the White House, and they're going to eventually. They're going to be screaming bloody murder when this is done to them.
That's right. Leslie, let me get your thoughts.
Well, As you know, gentlemen, I do like to put a silver lining, and I have a couple that I'm going to offer you right now. First, a full reading of what they actually did seems to show that the possibility of a Republican president and the Republican Senate pushing through pro-life justices was just too horrifying to the left, and so they didn't risk changing the rules on SCOTUS appointments. So the Supreme Court nominee protocol still requires the 60 votes for cloture for confirmation. So that remains intact, which is good news. But I'm going to have to say my new mantra, especially when we do get the Republican Senate, which is a matter of when, not if, is 51 votes for repeal. Imagine the day they repeal Obamacare on us. And if that isn't enough, something that may come a little quicker and would be nearly as satisfying would be they don't have to get a supermajority to replace Sebelius. Obama could replace Sebelius right out without a risk of a GOP filibuster. So that may be the best first step for the use of this new rule. Not saying it's
great,
but I'm just pointing out where some of the silver linings would be.
No, but you're right. I mean, and I do believe there's a very good chance of a Republican Senate this November. It certainly looks that way. It could change, but it looks that way. But I think Barry's right. Many of the controversial nominations were for this Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., and there were three of them in particular that were really to the left, and those were the three that were tied up. They're going to get in now. And that's going to have an impact on that particular court. I think the Supreme Court is still further down the road. Now, we're going to get into Vietnam tonight. We have Barry's going to tell us about Vietnam and a battle. But there is another point that I think you want to bring up, Leslie. You've been sharing some information regarding these groups of young men who are running around the country attacking people. Did you want to get into that tonight?
Yeah. Actually, why don't we turn it to Barry first, then I'll chime in, because Barry was the first one to bring this up on Facebook discussions.
Good.
Well, it's called the knockout game, or alternately it's called the polar bear hunt or polar bear hunting. It's where gangs of black youths walking down the street in various urban settings will randomly try to knock out with one punch a passerby. And the passerby is often a woman, often elderly. In Brooklyn, it seems to be possibly anti-Jewish. A lot of the attacks have been on Jews in Brooklyn who are identifiable because they're Orthodox and they're very, the way they dress is very unique. And there's been several fatalities. Now, what makes this game particularly, I say game, this activity, this crime, particularly galling and obnoxious is the way the press has ignored it. With the exception of Fox News, all the major media outlets have basically ignored this story. Now, let's just pretend for a moment that you had gangs of white youths all throughout America fanning out in the cities and going black bear hunting instead of polar bear hunting. And they were knocking out elderly black people or attacking black people randomly on the street or young black women, because that's what a lot of young white women have been attacked. And you think for a minute that the press would ignore it, or would there be town hall meetings all throughout the United States and a call by Sharpton, et cetera, the whole civil rights movement for dialogue and prosecutions and for somebody to do something about this. So it's very hypocritical that nothing is being done or even said about this.
The one thing that worries me, but I think it's going to happen, it's bound to happen, is that what if one of these people they attack happens to have a gun with them?
It's already happened.
It happened in
Michigan, in Lansing, Michigan. A father was waiting for his daughter to get off the school bus, and he was he had a youth come up to him and try to tase him, which is another version of the game. You try to knock him out with a taser, I guess. The guy stuck a stun gun into his chest, and he thought he'd been stabbed. He got hit so hard, he thought it was a knife stabbing him because it bruised a rib. And I think probably because he hit him too hard, it probably caused the stun gun to malfunction. But in any case, the guy then drew a gun that he had. It was a legal gun. He had a legal concealed carry permit. And he shot the young man twice, young black kid twice at close range. Didn't kill him, And, in fact, the young man was prosecuted, went to prison for 6 years, and has been on YouTube saying that he learned his lesson, that it was in some ways the best thing that ever happened to him because he woke him up.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, because that's what I believe is going to happen, is going to start happening, because people are going to start, particularly those who have the license to carry a gun here in Texas. I think, of course, it hasn't happened here in Texas, to my knowledge. It has happened in other places. But I think you're right about the double standard of the media. I mean, the fact that they're just not covering this at all. And yet, I've seen some of the videos like you have, Leslie and Barry, and it's really, I mean, it is horrific. There's one in particular where they threw a man and the guy hit his head on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a horrible. I mean, a really horrible scene.
Well, one thing that I reported, actually was reported in one of the blogs I write for, Legal Insurrection, was that it occurred on the Cornell University campus. Exact same thing went down. And what makes this so terrifying is that the perpetrators have utterly no compassion. They are devoid of feeling and empathy for the pain they are causing their victims. And if there's anything more evil than that, it would be hard to imagine. And
right.
One of those videos depict evil in my books.
Right. No, you're exactly right. You're exactly right about that. And the few that I've seen, I mean, I've seen them on Fox News. Greta has been doing a lot of coverage of that story. And there's one where there's a young woman walking, and he just comes around her and just knocks her down. I mean, it is really, really brutal. I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to take a break. We'll talk to Aaron Clary, and then when we come back, Barry and Leslie, we will do the rest of the show on Vietnam, and we'll let Barry tell us about that. Let's say hello to Aaron Clary. How are you, Aaron?
Hey, guys. What's up?
How is the weather up there, Aaron? We're going to be getting some rain tonight and some chilly rain. We might even get some sleet tonight. How about up there?
Well, we've had snow already, so the roads were a little bit icy. It was the first real snow that we've had, and sure enough, the rookie drivers clogged up the interstate, and there was a bad rush hour. But it's like, it's 25 degrees, but it's all right because I work at home, and I got myself a fireplace roaring with the fire, so I'm good to go.
Okay. Well, Leslie doesn't have to worry about snow. I mean, that's the beauty of San Diego.
No, I have to travel to get it, and I don't travel that far. So enjoy the snow. I'm perfectly content here with my nice warm weather.
That's right. That is, they say San Diego has the best weather in the country, and I believe it. I believe it. Well, Aaron, tell us about Captain Capitalism and bring us up to date on your book.
Well, the book, it's like trying to knock out. I'm in the 16th round with this big palooka in the ring, and it just isn't falling, but I got him on the ropes, and it'll be finished here hopefully in 2 weeks. So that book I got coming up, Bachelor Pad Economics, that should be written, and then off to the editors and all that it goes, so hopefully in 3 weeks, just before Christmas selling season, it'll be ready. Otherwise, that's about it. I've been, got captivecapitalism.blogspot.com if you want to come and, read my daily stuff. And I also do a podcast about once a week on random things that I randomly think about. There's really no rehearsal, which actually ends up becoming much better than I thought it would ever come out when I'm just kind of rambling. So, no, that's about it. Just chugging along and trying to knock out that book. It's going to be like 450 pages, and it'll be done in 2.5 months total.
Wow. Now, tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, the book is designed to be the financial advice Bible for all men and women that can tolerate my somewhat crass and lewd language. It is a book for guys, but, finance and economics, that applies universally to everybody. So, but it is targeted towards men and boys. So it's, in theory, you should pick this up at the age of 14, and it will carry you until your death. So it talks about what you should study in school, picking up trades, learning how to fix cars, learning how to do carpentry, then what do you major in, how to go about approaching your career, dating girls, marrying girls, having children, insurance, 401k plans. I'm even going all the way into estate planning so that when you're, you know, an 85-year-old guy could buy this book and still get something out of it. So that's basically the general gist of the book.
So this book ties in. I'll let Leslie ask you
yeah,
a question.
I have to comment.
Minute.
I really
yeah,
have
ahead,
to comment, Silvio, because I've had the privilege of editing three of those chapters. And Aaron's right. If you're a woman, you need to be chill with manly humor, which I am, because it's a fabulous read if you are. And his chapter on entrepreneurship it will be worth the entire price that he charges for the book alone, and well worth women who want to succeed in business reading.
Wow, that is interesting. Now, of course, by what you just told us, your book has a connection to the other book, Worthless, you know. The other book about selecting a major and, you know, getting the best out of your college expenditures.
Right. And, you know, Bachelor of Pad Economics, it's a reference book, and it can't tell you everything because each subject is a book unto itself. And I certainly reference, like, for further research, please consult Worthless. And then, you know, some other things I reference, Enjoy the Decline and other books that I've read. So, yeah, it's not the answer to everything. But for kids that don't, you know, boys, even girls who don't have, like, a father, didn't have someone to, like, lead them, and no older brother, nobody says, hey, here's the ropes, kid. Here's, you know, here, avoid these mistakes I did. This is that book. And so, I mean, really, I have a hard time imagining if a kid picked this up at the age of 14, they wouldn't come out $500,000 richer by the time they retire, because I've made plenty of mistakes, and if I didn't make them, I'd be $100,000 easy ahead by now. So hopefully it helps out a lot of boys and girls.
Now, so a young woman who reads your book, what would she get out of the book?
Well, it's the exact same thing she'd get that a guy would. You know, 401k rules are the same for men and women. Employment, the labor market is the same for men and women. About the only chapter that wouldn't, or two chapters that wouldn't apply is dating girls, because they're probably more interested in boys. And then I have a section on choosing a wife, and a subsection called wife training, and all this stuff, that's not going to imply, and it will probably irk them and get them a little miffed, but if they can get past that, everything, all the advice would equally apply to women.
Yeah, for example, Aaron might recommend, you know, getting a sugar mama for a young college man, really not applicable to most young ladies out there. So, but I think girls are smart enough if they wanted to switch around the device and actually get a male's perspective that make shake up what they do in a positive way.
A sugar mama? One of these days we have to do a show on that, Aaron.
I'm just saying, I wish I would have done back when I was in college. It would have been a lot easier to have a sugar mama pay for my tuition. But yeah, it could be applied for girls too. They just got to get themselves a sugar daddy. That's it.
Well, what I'll do is when we do that show, we'll have some young people join us.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, and you can get the book, of course, at Amazon or at the website, Captain Capitalism.
Right, just go to Amazon.com, look up my name, and just like your book, you'll find it all there. You can look up Cubanos in Wisconsin, you can find Worthless, you can find Enjoy the Decline. It's all there on Amazon and Kindle, and then Worthless is also in audio book format as well.
And by the way, thanks for the promotion of Cubanos in Wisconsin. We appreciate that very much. And we'll talk to you, well, not next Thursday. We won't do a show next Thursday because it's Thanksgiving. A couple of Thursdays in, I guess the first Thursday in December, we'll chat with you again.
All right, so I'll hopefully have the book finished by that time.
Okay, all right. Aaron Clary, Captain Capitalism. We have a link on the show information to his books. Let's bring Barry back. And Barry, we're going to go Vietnam the rest of the show, so I think you're probably ready.
I am ready. Then we're going to talk about the battle of the Anadyrang Valley.
All right. Well, I'm going to turn it over to Leslie, and we should have a pretty good 20 minutes of this. So let's hear it.
Well, let me just start by asking Barry the first basic question. What's important about the Battle of the Anadyrang Valley, which actually was November 14th, 1965? Set it up for us.
Well, in 1965, the United States committed major ground forces to the Republic of South Vietnam to stem a communist insurrection. that had been going on for many years, but it escalated in the preceding years with large forces from communist North Vietnam, a separate country to the north, invading the south via the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which paralleled the Cambodian border. It was just inside Cambodia. And then the communists would use that as a major supply route into the south. And they were infiltrating large regular formations of the People's Army of Vietnam, which was the North Vietnamese Army, into the central highlands of Vietnam. And the central highlands, if you think of Vietnam, you've got to think of it as looking like a T-bone steak, that the narrowest point is in the north where the DMZ was between north and south. And the country broadened out towards the delta of the Mekong River, south of Saigon, the capital. And the narrowest section of South Vietnam was the Central Highlands section, where there was a mountainous region bordering Cambodia. And then when the highlands dropped off towards the coastal plain, it was a very narrow section. And this is in the province of Pleiku. So the North Vietnamese, the communist strategy was to cut the country in two by occupying the Central Highlands and running patrols and attacks from the Central Highlands to cut that coastal road and thus divide the country in two. So when American forces were deployed in early 1965, it became apparent that we need to stop this. And that led to the Battle of the I Drang Valley. I Drang Valley is a valley in the middle of the Central Highlands near a place called Play May. And it was a site in November of 1965 of the first battle between the North Vietnamese regulars, the People's Army of Vietnam, and the U.S. Army. It was our first major clash. And that's why it's so important.
And we were watching in preparation. We Were Soldiers, which is just a wonderful film by Mel Gibson. And the Lieutenant Moore, Lieutenant Colonel Moore, excuse me, was focused on the Battle of Little Bighorn in preparation for the battle. Why was this so? How is it going to apply to this particular event?
Well, first of all, Lieutenant Colonel Hal Moore was the commander of the 1st Battalion of the 7th Cavalry. And if the 7th Cavalry sounds familiar, it's because that was General George Armstrong Custer's regiment that was destroyed by the Sioux Indians during the Indian Wars at the Battle of Little Bighorn. Now, the area where Hal Moore was going to be taking his unit, which, by the way, was the first air mobile unit in the U.S. Army. You know, we think of helicopters and air mobile assault as sort of a standard, you know, battle tactic. Troops fly in by helicopter. Helicopter gunships support them. But that was brand new in 1965. And the unit that pioneered that style of warfare was the 1st Cavalry Division, of which the 7th Cavalry was the spearhead unit. Hal Moore was the guy that pioneered this, and he was going to be taking his boys into the I Drang Valley, where the French, during the 1950s, particularly around 1954, the French Foreign Legion had mobile columns just massacred by the communists in that region. And while he was doing his homework, it occurred to him that he's going to be landing in these isolated areas with waves of troops coming in. But essentially, the first boots on the ground are going to be limited to about 90 guys. That's because they only have so many helicopters to ferry troops in. And if he got pinned down on the landing zone, which they call LZ, and if that LZ got overrun, he'd be cut off, surrounded, and wiped out by possibly vastly superior forces. So he was really worried that this would be another massacre of the 7th Cavalry. This time he would be playing the role of Custer.
Yeah, not something that lends itself to warm embracing for most military men, I'm sure. But what precautions could he have taken? I mean, was he under orders to go in there directly? Was he able to do anything to prepare?
No, not really. I mean, what happened was that the Special Forces camp nearby at Play May was under attack. For the preceding month up till the Battle of I Drang, we were running patrols into that area. And the Vietnamese, for their part, the North Vietnamese were surprised at how effective our air mobile tactics were. know, what they would do is they would attack a camp. And this is what they originally planned. They'd attack a camp that was isolated or fortress isolated, like the Special Forces camp at Playmay. And then they'd wait in ambush along the road with a much larger force for the relief column, which was normally, you know, armored vehicles and trucks, to come riding up the road to rescue, you know, the trapped, the besieged garrison. They'd done this to the French. They'd done this to the South Vietnamese. And as the relief force would come up the road, they would ambush it. But with helicopters, we didn't need to ride up this road anymore. We could basically airlift artillery into positions surrounding the area to give close artillery support, bring troops in by helicopters to break up the North Vietnamese formations, the communist formations, which had to scatter like quail before incoming American troops. And we basically got them on the run, and we kept them on the run. And leading up to the Battle of Ai Trang, we had no idea how big a force there was in that area. We just knew they were there. We'd been chasing small elements. Turned out that there was the elements of three regiments, basically a division of North Vietnamese regulars in a mountain overlooking the Ai Trang Valley that had dug tunnels underneath the mountain. They had a base camp in these tunnels. So on November 14th, Hal Moore is given the mission to land his battalion, just under 400 men, coming in various waves, to land them in the valley and spread out and try to find where the enemy is. And this will lead to the battle around that landing zone called LZ X-ray, landing zone X-ray. The first wave comes in, hits the ground, helicopters take off immediately to go back and bring in the next wave. And the first platoons on the ground, including Colonel Moore, who was the first guy on the ground, they immediately spread out and secure the perimeter 360 degrees around this shallow bowl that is the landing zone. And it's surrounded by ridges on all sides and then a mountain.
Now, how much time before the next wave comes in to reinforce them?
About 45 minutes.
Okay.
That didn't turn out to really be the issue because, as it turned out, The North Vietnamese did not bank on the new American doctrine, which turned out to be so effective, of close artillery support, meaning that very small forces of Americans would, when they were attacked, would just dig in, stay small, you know, get in their foxholes, get behind cover, lay down what fire they could, but then call in close artillery support from nearby fire support bases. Artillery that's brought in also by helicopter a few miles away, and provide a shield between them and the much larger North Vietnamese forces. So basically a platoon of Americans can take on a battalion of North Vietnamese troops. So what ends up happening is they land there on the landing zone, and there's immediately a mishap. A lieutenant named Henry Herrick from a long-standing military family, but he's a green shave tail. He's, you know, he's a butter bar. Brand new lieutenant, and he leads his platoon on a chase, breaking the perimeter and running into the woods, chasing a couple of decoys, a couple of North Vietnamese troops he sees out there in the woods. And his platoon, which will become known as the Lost Platoon, gets isolated deep in the woods, and then it's attacked from all sides by the North Vietnamese, cut off and attacked. And in fact, Herrick is killed along with his platoon sergeant in the opening seconds of that ambush. And it falls upon a young buck sergeant, 21-year-old buck sergeant named Ernie Savage, to take command of this platoon, about 30 Americans, and taking a position in the tall grass on top of a knoll, they defend themselves with artillery, calling in artillery, and keeping the North Vietnamese from overrunning their position. And they'll actually be isolated from their main battalion and lost for the entire battle, for two nights. So that's the first mishap. The second is that Hal Moore realizes that the enemy is in way more strength than he or the brass back in Saigon had expected when he captures one of the enemy, captures a scout. And the scout tells him that up in that mountain, he points to a mountain overlooking the LZ, and there's this big, tall knoll. And he says, you know, that's the base camp for division, basically 4,000 Vietnamese troops.
Yeah, to the maybe 400 that is going to get there, but in waves. So they're feeling very custardish at this point, I would imagine.
They really are. And the main mission and the whole impetus, this entire battle, will be about keeping that LZ open, keep me LZ X-ray, the open area in the bottom of this bowl they're defending, open, and it'll be the job of the mission of the North Vietnamese troops to cross the perimeter, break the perimeter, overrun their position, and knock out that LZ, take over that LZ, so that helicopters can't come in with resupply, reinforcements, and to take out the wounded. And this goes on for 3 days. The battle actually is a three-day battle, 2 days and 3 days and two nights. And only artillery support keeps them, the North Vietnamese, at bay. And, in fact, at one point during the second day, Hal Moore's command post, which was in a little grove of bamboo trees and surrounded by petrified termite mounds, is overrun by the North Vietnamese. They actually break through the perimeter, get down to the down where his command post is, and it gets down to literally pistols, where even the wounded are picking up weapons and shooting, because the wounded are collected right there. And one of the photojournalists, the only photojournalist who took pictures of this battle, was a guy named Joe Galloway. And Galloway was the guy that co-wrote the book with Hal Moore, We Were Soldiers Once. And he actually had to pick up a rifle, an M16, that had been laid there by one of the wounded or dead, and he's the only civilian ever in the Vietnam War, possibly ever in American history, to get the Bronze Star for valor, and that he helped defend the wounded with an M16 during that battle.
Wow. So things are looking pretty dire at this point. What happens next?
Well, throughout the whole battle, it's not just Hal Moore thinking Custer's last stand here. You know, back in Saigon, the brass are monitoring the radio traffic, and Westmoreland's headquarters suddenly realize they may have a PR disaster on their hands. It's one thing to lose a few hundred Americans. That's a bad day. But when you lose the battalion commander and the battalion with him, that now you have Custer's last stand. So throughout the 3 days, they're trying to get Hal Moore to actually leave his troops there and evacuate himself out of there so that he doesn't become a casualty. And Hal Moore, to his credit, refused to leave without his boys. He refused to budge. During the second day, his perimeter was broken on all sides. The North Vietnamese were making a three-prong attack. The North Vietnamese commander was very savvy, and he realized that the only way to fight the Americans was to get to a battle of the belt, where he basically grabbed them, he called it belt level. You grab onto their belt, hold on tight. Because then if you get that close quarter battle, they can't drop artillery on you without hitting themselves. So they did this, and they actually overran the entire west side of the perimeter, broke down into LZ English. The LZ was cut off. They had to use explosive charges to clear trees and actually open up a new LZ so supplies could come in. But his command post, Hal Moore's command post, is overrun. And at that point, Moore called Broken Arrow. And that's a code that U.S. military forces use, which tells everybody listening on the radio that an American unit is about to be overrun, that it's being overrun and needs immediate support. And it calls in every single aircraft in the theater to their support. And that's what happened. Every American plane, from aircraft carriers to air bases on the ground, sent whatever attack planes they had over to LZ English in the Central Highlands. And they were apparently stacked up in waves, thousands of feet above, just dropping every ordnance they could on the LZ English, and including on the American positions. That's part of Broken Arrow, is basically drop it right on your position. And you just get small. You just get down in your foxhole and hope that the enemy who's running around overrunning you, they're up and they're exposed and they'll be killed, and you down in your foxhole, you'll survive. And that's what happened. The Vietnamese attack was broken, and thousands end up being killed. I mean, they lost, we know at least 600, we think as much as 1,500 were killed, and the highest estimate was as much as 2,000. The Vietnamese always dragged their bodies off wherever they could, and we'd count the blood trails. That was one of the ways we kind of estimated casualties. But it turned out being one hell of a battle. And the less than 400 men of the 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry, with lots of artillery and air support, were able to defeat about 3,000 North Vietnamese and the death count was about a 10-to-1 ratio and as much as 15-to-1 perhaps in our favor, which is a tremendous victory militarily, even though it was a very, very tough fight throughout.
Wow. Barry, I have a quick question. What was the political impact of this battle? I mean, was this one that was covered heavily back here?
It wasn't covered by the press so much. I mean, it got some coverage. Callaway, of course, was taking pictures.
Right.
They got published. After the battle was over, reporters came in waves to, you know, review the battle. But it was heavily reviewed by both the North Vietnamese command and by Westmoreland and McNamara. And, in fact, Hal Moore was flown to Saigon, and he was briefed by McNamara in person, who had flown to South Vietnam, and by Westmoreland. And interesting enough, both sides, both the communist North, the People's Army of Vietnam, and the American Army, came to the conclusion that they won, that they've each won the battle.
Mm-hmm.
Each one viewed it as a victory for different reasons. We called it a victory because we held the battlefield at the end of the battle, and we'd killed them 15-to-1. You know, our force was unbroken. They had survived being overrun and still defeated the enemy. The lost patrol, the lost platoon, by the way, was eventually recovered. And Sergeant Savage, by the way, got a Distinguished Service Cross for his defense of the knoll and keeping the lost platoon intact despite constant attacks throughout the 3 days. Hal Moore got a Distinguished Service Cross. And the Medal of Honor actually went to two Medal of Honors were given out to the helicopter pilots who kept the troops resupplied and brought out the wounded. And, you know, they did a tremendous job under fire. And that, one of the things that proved to the Americans was that the Huey helicopter, which became the iconic helicopter of the Vietnam War, could, in fact, do that sort of mission. It could go into a hot LZ under fire and was sturdy enough. And this was a concern before the battle, that it would be sturdy enough to take fire and still keep flying. And it did this, you know, despite the fact that every one of their helicopters that came in were of the aviation battalion were just shot full of holes. They kept flying, and none of them were disabled during the battle. So the Americans thought they won for that reason, because we outkilled them, and we proved that our doctrine of close air and close artillery support would allow very small elements of the Americans. It's important. Let me throw this in there, Sylvia. It's very important to note that in guerrilla warfare, the reason the North Vietnamese were so successful against the French and against the South Vietnamese before we got there was that if ever a smaller force of the government troops, of the French or the North South Vietnamese, went out patrolling, they could be ambushed by larger forces of the guerrillas, of the Viet Cong. And if a larger force came along by road or through the jungle, the guerrillas could always just scatter and get away. So they could always fight the battle on their terms. What the helicopter allowed is very, very small elements of American forces to go out and patrol in the most rugged areas. And if they were attacked by superior enemy forces, they could call in artillery and air support. And so a small platoon could fight off effectively a battalion of the enemy, you know, hundreds more of the enemy. So it allowed us to fight a guerrilla war on our terms. So that's why we thought we won. And the reason the North Vietnamese thought they had won the Battle of Vai Trang is they had tested against our doctrine, and they felt they'd come across, they found a way to beat us. They knew it would be a long-term battle. They knew America had entered, you know, it had brought a new wrinkle, a tactic that they had to find a way to beat, but they thought they had found a way to beat it. And so they thought they had they came away from the battle with something valuable that they could use to win the war.
Right. Interesting. Let me tie Vietnam to President Kennedy. We started with that. Obviously, when President Kennedy was killed, there were, 20,000 troops in Vietnam. They were not in any kind of combat capacity, to my knowledge. Maybe I'm wrong. But the big question, and we don't have a lot of time, but I just wanted to ask a quick answer from you. Do you believe that had President Kennedy not been assassinated and been reelected, which is very likely, that he would have escalated the Vietnam War?
I think he would have. I've heard it said otherwise, that he would have been wise enough not to, but I really don't see any evidence of that. Robert McNamara was Secretary of Defense under Kennedy as well as Johnson,
right.
And McNamara has never said that. What happened was we had advisors who were whether they were combat troops or not is it's a matter of semantics. They were leading South Vietnamese and Mountain Yard forces. We had whole groups of special forces in there fighting against the communists. So we had combat troops under Kennedy. They just weren't whole regular formations.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And McNamara himself said that after the Battle of I Drang, he sent a memo to Johnson saying that everything has changed, that in his estimate, the North Vietnamese have committed major ground forces to the South. It's not just a local insurrection, as we thought, as it had been earlier. That the Viet Cong now are augmented by the PAVN, the People's Army of Vietnam, which is the North Vietnamese Army. And they have a willingness, based on I Drang, they basically have a willingness, or shown a willingness, to stand up and fight set-piece battles and to accept very heavy casualties. So McNamara actually said that the timetable that Johnson had him on, which was that we win the war by 67, from 65 to 67, we will basically won the war, is no longer viable. And that by 67, mm-hmm. we will be way behind our timetable and be still in a protracted battle.
Wow. Interesting. Well, one of these days we need to do a show about some of the lessons that the United States learned from Vietnam. That might be a good topic, military lessons of Vietnam that future generations learned. A lot of the leadership that fought in Iraq and Afghanistan was leadership that came from Vietnam, wasn't it? I mean, some of the generals and lieutenants and all of that right now were men who fought in Vietnam, so they remember that quite well.
Well, in fact, the Powell Doctrine, developed by Colin Powell, was developed out of the experience of Vietnam. I mean, Colin Powell had been a young officer during the Vietnam War.
Right.
And the lessons basically, he said, because the Powell Doctrine was this, and there's a lot more to be said about Vietnam, and it really demands its own show, but the Powell Doctrine was simply put that on a strategic level, don't commit our forces to a war that we don't have an end strategy, that we can't get in and out of fairly quickly, and we can't fight with our hands tied behind our back, that we basically
right.
have to go in there and do what needs to be done and do it quickly.
That's right. That's right. You're exactly right. Well, I want to thank you so much, Barry and Leslie. Another great show tonight. This is a great topic, and we probably should do a show about Vietnam sometime later. But, Barry, I want to wish you a happy Thanksgiving, and hopefully we'll get you back in
next
December
month.
Or January. Next month? Okay.
Yeah, next
Leslie,
month.
Tell us about the next show. Obviously, next Thursday night we won't be on, but
the next three shows, Mandy will be on for the monthly Obamacare disaster review, followed by what will become our program psychologist for how to get through the holidays with families, especially when they encounter political discussions. And then we'll get Barry on to do something appropriate with military history for the third week in December. He just doesn't know it yet because I haven't talked to him about it yet.
Let me make a suggestion for that. You mentioned President Nixon earlier when we were talking about Vietnam. One of the most decisive decisions that President Nixon made was what came to be known as the Christmas bombing, where this was Christmas 1972, where there were bombs all over. I mean, he really, as I understand it, I mean, they really bombed North Vietnam, and that was a very effective ending to at least it got the Vietnamese back on to the negotiating table. So that might be a topic worth mentioning as we get closer to Christmas time.
Yeah,
but
I was thinking something along the lines of military history exploits around Christmas. So that'll tie nicely into that theme.
Well, there's another big Christmas story, too, having to do with the military, not directly, but, the passing of Glenn Miller. Glenn Miller disappeared. I think on the 23rd of December he went to Paris to perform for the troops. There's also the Battle of the Bulge. That's another big one, too, that happened in late December. So those are just a couple of ideas for our next show. So, we can do more than one topic, but there's a couple of them.
I like it. I'm excited.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, guys, thank you so much. Leslie, as always, thank you for your great work. And Barry, thank you for your great participation. I hope both of you have a wonderful Thanksgiving with your families, and we will be in touch again. I forgot what day it is, but whatever the two Thursdays, I think it's the fourth, isn't it, when we're back together again to do another one of our shows.
Yes, exactly. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving,
Leslie. Yeah, happy Thanksgiving, Leslie. Happy Thanksgiving, Barry, and thank you to the listeners. This was a great show tonight, and we'll talk to you the next time. Good night, everybody.